I'd like to introduce Dr. Moynihan, who will be speaking to managing the high-risk perioperative handout.
Good morning, everyone. I will take the next 5 or 10 minutes just to summarize some of the key points that both Kevin and Juan have made, and then share with you a couple of situations where the principles of what we learned this morning are applied in true clinical environments that we work in every day. I have nothing to disclose as well. So I think we would all agree that this morning's session is really about communication. And when communication goes wrong, whether it's the race car industry, the airline industry, or the world that we work in, it's a major safety concern for all of us and for our patients. Juan alluded to the fact that the Joint Commission back in 2006 really set the standard for what a good handoff would be. And they listed 8 steps, as you can see on this slide. And it seems to be a cumbersome way to think about it, but the principles are all there. Face-to-face communication, good discussion, an agreed-to template for sharing of information. And I really think it boils down to 4 essential components or 4 concepts. The use of forms and checklists, which you've heard about this morning, a direct and instantaneous sharing of information, using information in context, whether that's the electronic medical record, recent laboratory data, those pieces of information that are tools to sharing and ensuring a good handoff, and then addressing the organization and cultural aspects of those handoffs. Each of our institutions and organizations is different. Handoffs take time, but that time is worth it. But sometimes handoffs fail. Juan mentioned earlier that the Joint Commission has identified somewhere between 70 and 80% of sentinel events across the United States occur because of poor handoffs. 43% of communication errors actually occur in the postoperative period. That's an amazing number of times. And interestingly, literature supports that it's less a factor of the poor quality of the information shared, but more of the data that's omitted in those handoffs that makes a difference. You've seen the version of this slide earlier this morning, but I think it's impressive when you think about the number of touch points a patient who has surgery goes through on their journey to the operating room. They could leave the ED, they could end up on the floor in the holding room, they might be coming from the intensive care unit, but the one area that I'll focus on for the next 5 minutes or so are 2 in particular. What happens postoperatively? 1, to the recovery room, or for those patients that have to go to the intensive care unit, why are those unique environments on a patient's journey? Looking back at anesthesia claims data in 2002, 14% of 419 anesthesia malpractice claims were actually related to poor communication in the recovery room. And a survey by the Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundation just in October a year ago of their members showed that less than 50% of the people when surveyed thought that handoffs were even good, never mind excellent. There was often, as I suggested, a significant amount of missing information, things that you would think would be basic to a handoff, the ASA status, what antibiotics were received, if any, what fluids and how much were received. In a study by Siddiqui in 2012, for 29 metrics that were considered to be essential pieces of information in a PACU handoff, only 2 out of those 29 were identified consistently in 90% of the handoffs. Talk about omitting data. And who hasn't brought a patient to the recovery room when the receiving team is often multitasking? They're answering a phone, you might be answering a page, that patient gets transferred into the recovery room. How are we going to share that important information when we're doing a number of different things? And there are operational impacts as well. Bittner reported in 2012 that poor handoffs frequently can lead to an increased length of stay in our recovery rooms. So I thought I would share with you, there are a number of different templates out there, as Dr. Sanchez shared earlier. Here's one from Memorial Sloan Kettering that was reported in 2017. And it's pretty simple. It has the mnemonic that Kevin spoke about earlier, puts patient first. It has, if you go block by block, those important elements. What's the patient's name? What procedure did they have done? What kind of an anesthetic was used? Was there any significant past medical history or allergies? What's the immediate expected events in the next 30 minutes in the PACU? That's an important thing to share with the receiving team. What fluids did they get? What records are reviewed if the receiving team has questions about the patient's past medical history? And who will be accepting the care after they leave the recovery room? It seems pretty simple, but it's extensive, and it reflects, I believe, from this Memorial Sloan Kettering mnemonic, an easy way to address and reduce the number of omitted pieces of information. The other situation clinically where patients are at risk is the intensive care unit, the transfer of the patient from the OR to the ICU. And it's error prone for a number of different reasons. What a complex team, right? The surgeon, and for many of us, our residents or our fellows who come with us, the OR nursing team, and maybe the OR nursing student who's coming upstairs to the unit, the anesthesia providers, the CRNA and the MDA, the ICU staff, respiratory therapy, the lab, X-ray, all of those people are going to be in the room when that patient arrives in the ICU. And those patients are often critically ill and hemodynamically unstable. And think of all the support that's necessary to transfer a patient from the OR to the ICU. A number of different monitors, often a mechanical ventilator. What drips are they on? Any kind of circulatory support, drains, all those things that have to be recorded. McElroy identified in 2015, they are critical to the handoff. And what a demanding physical transfer. Not only are the teams needing to move all those devices, they have to move them safely, and you can't lose a connection. In fact, McElroy reported in the same article that that's truly interrupted care twice. Once getting them from the OR table to the ICU bed, and then from the ICU bed to the actual ICU. In 2011, believe it or not, there were a number of handoffs that Joy reported on where the equipment wasn't available in the ICU. Nobody had made the call. The ventilator wasn't there. A missing piece of equipment or a monitor that was necessary for that particular patient. And as Juan suggested, handoffs really can't be done if it's in a noisy room. There has to be the entire team and the ability to share the information that's important. So in our heart and vascular operating rooms, in full transparency, we had a number of events that caught our attention and a new look at how those handoffs were done for that critical population of patients. And we made the mistake, I think, that a lot of institutions make, which was the surgeons thought that they would develop a handoff, and anesthesia thought they might develop one too. And it wasn't until the nurses said, hold on, you guys, we got to do this together. It has to be a team effort. It has to be a sharing of information among disciplines, as we heard earlier. And it has to be something that's structured and repeatable and documentable in the ability to be tracked. So it's a busy slide, but it shows, I think, if you can read it, three component parts to a good handoff for these patients that are in our heart and vascular operating rooms. One is the first call. As the patient's getting ready to be packed up, some piece of communication that alerts the team in the ICU that the patient's on the way. And then a second call, just as they're leaving the operating room, we're on the way, and the data points are, as you can see, I won't go through those line by line. And then importantly, the bedside communication piece. Everybody's there, it's quiet, the patient has arrived, and all those things are again reviewed to ensure a good and solid data-filled handoff. So if we learned anything at all from that exercise, it was that it was a time for change for our institution in terms of handoffs. We had to have a system-wide commitment, not only by us as caregivers, but by our organization, leadership, and executives. Everybody had to participate because there was no question that patient safety was impacted. There had to be training. It had to be multimodal and multi-level. Everybody needed to be involved and had to be supported by our EMR and our analytics team. There had to be feedback. Human factors engineers have to be involved, as Juan suggested. It's a cultural process that doesn't happen overnight. It takes time, but it's worth the investment. And you need a project manager to help drive it. There's no point in putting a handoff template in place and not tracking whether or not it's effective over time. They're not documents that are built in stone, but they're documents that should be fluid, that can be addressed and changed as the patient care changes. So handoffs are important. I think we've all learned that this morning. When they're done successfully, they make a difference in the care of our patients. And I'd like to turn it back over to Dr. Sanchez for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We have time for questions, so I just wanted to ask a couple questions before we start. First to Kevin, what do you think the future holds in terms of technology? You talked a little bit about technology, and you're obviously engaged in telemonitoring. But with the advent of artificial intelligence and natural language processing, are there technologies out there that will help us in handoffs and reducing these miscommunication issues, or are they just going to compound the problem?
Yes. I think both. The technology in of itself is always a little bit of a risk because of reliability, that sort of thing, but there's no question when it comes to supporting decision-making that, as I alluded earlier, quantification is valuable. I'll give you a simple example. If you look at cardiac surgery risk models, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, it takes patients' preoperative risk factors in the proposed procedure, and it tells you the risk of death, major complications, length of stay, and even readmissions. But anybody in this room would realize that that's a rather static number, and it's far more dynamic, i.e., okay, now something's happened in the operating room or in the ICU, and you know we need to quantify who's on shift and how many people and what's the complexity of the unit and who's the responsible physician, that sort of thing. And some of those models are already there. I read about this, I want to say it was a year ago in the Wall Street Journal. It was some Northeastern hospital that had that sort of data being crunched in real time in the background to help share with the team so they understood the risk of the patient, but also the team, the environment that they were in. You know, I'm going to digress for a second because that was a great question, but give you a real-world example of a failed handoff between doctor and nurse. The doctor was me. The nurse was my wife. The setting was at our cottage, and we have standard operating procedure. We've communicated well for a long time. My wife's great with people. I'm good at doing things. So the way this would usually work as we were packing up and getting ready to leave is my wife would be packing things up and organizing the girls. Things would get put by the back door, and I was the one that would load them into the car. And at one point, my wife said, did you get that bag? Or no, did you take that bag out? Yes, it was a garbage bag. I took that out. I put the other bags in the car, that sort of thing. So did you take the bag out? Yes. Okay, we get home. Where are my clothes? What do you mean? They were in that bag by the back door. Well, that was a garbage bag. I took it out, like you said. I threw away all of her clothes. So having a way to have standard operating procedure, communicate, be very clear about what we meant was incredibly important. I've used that to describe the importance with our team, but I mean, that's a graphic example of people that do things a certain way all the time, but I failed rather miserably in that case.
Any other questions? Any comments, questions?
Rekha Singh from New Britain, Connecticut. I have a question about what strategies can you use to avoid leading errors, like the receiver is not necessarily using critical thinking skills to make their own assessment and understanding of a situation. And so they're being led to a certain conclusion by the person performing the handoff. What are strategies to prevent that?
So that's an interesting question, and again, the assumption is the shared mental model is an accurate one from the very beginning, and you're trying to achieve the sharing of information, you're assuming that the mental model is actually accurate. But as we know, there are an enormous amounts of inherent biases and issues that that go on. And you would hope that by creating an environment where the receiver is facilitating, or the sender is facilitating questions from the receiver and clarification, and not just absorbing the information wholesale, that kind of dialogue is actually synergistic and creates a different shared mental model that would hopefully be a more accurate one. So now you have two professionals talking about a particular case using facts that might synthesize a different or at least an altered mental model that would be better than the one that the receiver was, I'm sorry, that the sender was intending. So I think it's that idea of an iterative communication and discourse that actually creates value in that now you have more brain power thinking about the problem. But the initial part of it where we transmit information without transmitting the sense of urgency or the concerns creates an enormous gap, which could be potentially filled in by the receiver if the space is allowed for that to happen. But if it's just a one-way transactional event, you're never going to get to that new shared mental model.
Yeah, I would sort of reiterate the way I think about it is, and describe it to the team, is the patient needs to be in the box. So they need to know what that box is, what the goals are commonly. And then what is it that we do when they seem like they're starting to deviate or they've already gotten outside of the box, and those have to be routine things. So standard operating procedure, shared mental model, quantifying things is important. And it makes me think of that old Bill Murray quote where he says, it's hard to win an argument with a smart person, but it's damn near impossible to win with a stupid person. So if the team doesn't know what's supposed to happen, there isn't an organized, thoughtful way of thinking about it, you're sort of prey to everybody's own way of thinking of things and doing things, and it becomes incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I think that's where the structured approach makes the difference. And if all elements of the team, all members of the team come together to develop that structured approach, and you can depersonalize, in a sense, those extraneous emotional impact to this handoff. It's not to say that you want to stifle discussion, but there are certain data points in whatever the scenario is, clinical scenario, that have to be shared, and they have to be a structured approach.
Daniel Picard from Baltimore, former chairman. I work for the CLEAR organization, ACGME. I'm not sure how aware either the college or anybody in the surgical community of the disastrous issues related to communication in the OR. Visiting hospitals every day of the week, big, small, or anything in between, you can see things that you might be amazed. Surgeons who don't write post-op orders immediately or never. Never get out of the OR to talk to the nurses, forget about the residents. Maybe they send PAs, maybe they don't. Maybe there's delays, and that could be in major institutions. I'm not sure we're doing here in this organization a really great job at sounding the alarm, because it is potentially catastrophic, and I've seen that in many hospitals. I see 40 hospitals a year, probably, or so, and the same number of ORs. So just bring that up to your attention.
No, I appreciate that comment, and it is emblematic of the gap, the huge gap we have between best practices and the real world. And as we identify best practices and our science, our understanding of the science of systems thinking evolves, and we look at what actually happens every day, that gap is getting worse. And so this whole idea of implementation science and trying to close that gap is an important endeavor for us as professionals, as surgeons, and as a college. We have a number of different initiatives in the college looking at doing just that, but it's very, very difficult when there's great variability in the way we practice across the country. So being able to share best practices like we do here is a good start, but there's a lot more to be done. Any comments? Dr. Burgess, any perspective from your end, given that Canadians are a little different? My wife is one of them. So, you know, you have a different, more collaborative style of practice, perhaps. Any thoughts?
Yes. One of the things that I actually, just listening to all these talks and looking at checklists and data points, quality indicators, and what we're talking about with different mnemonics, one question or one thing that comes up to me is, how do we make sure that these quality indicators are A, valid, because the more data we have, there's more data to sift through, and B, how do we communicate them in a universal fashion? We've seen examples of multiple mnemonics, a lot of them saying the same things, but in different ways. And I know that even between institutions in my own cities, we have to do the same checklist or handover, but we each institution does them slightly different. So the question is, how do we make sure the information that we're trying to transmit is valid, and how do we actually do it in the same way? And I don't know that anywhere on the planet does that well.
Please.
Hi, I'm Beth Jeffers from Michigan. I have a question from... This sounds good when you're in the ICU or you're in a closed unit or you have like one shift coming, one shift going. How does this work in the real world when you have five partners, each during the day are doing surgery in different areas or different hospitals, and then someone's taking over for the weekend? How, like, you're all in different locations, you're all seeing different things, you're all working at different times and have different responsibilities. How do you see that working in a real world with a real practice with real partners? Getting a similar kind of a handoff.
I'll take that on. I think you have to think about it like an engineering problem, and you say, okay, who's around, what is the most likely convenient time, what tools do we have, whether it's your electronic health record or something that you write down, and then you go back to some of these basic principles that you've heard, whether it's iPass or Sign Out Safer or SBAR, whatever it may be, and the demand is we are going to sign out to each other at a time each day in a way, and you stay committed. One of the things that I find incredibly valuable, and it sort of bridges the quality metrics in a question like you asked, is, again, quantifying things, measuring things, did it happen or not? The most recent operating system upgrade shows us how many times a day we pick the thing up, how many times we use it. And when I saw it, I was alarmed. The first week, I reduced my use by 43%. So if somebody told you, you know, you were going to hand off and you sort of designed that with your five partners, and you found out you were only doing it 25% of the time, I think that's a real driver for people to say, we need to do better. That's the way I would think about it.
And I think each group will develop their own template to... Ashley's earlier comment, it would be great if we had standard across the entire world for what a handoff would be, but one shoe doesn't fit all. So the five of you, or 10 of you, however many in your group, are going to have to determine, as Kevin said, we're going to talk at 4 o'clock on this day, and these are the key elements in the patient list, and you're going to have to just run through them. There's a certain personal accountability, I think.
The other thing that I would say is that we know there's a concept called the Heinrich ratio, in which for every major adverse event, there are 30 minor events preceding it, and there are 300 unsafe acts or near misses. So I'm sure there are tons of near misses happening all the time within your group, and being able to identify that and openly discuss, look, we could have really hurt this patient because we didn't use good practices here, and just, you know, shining a light on all those near misses that are happening probably every time you shift might sort of give you an idea of the magnitude of the problem, and the idea that, you know, at any one time any of us could have a catastrophic outcomes because of a communication failure.
Yeah, I would probably reinforce, it just came to me, whatever we do, keep it simple. You know, the old KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid. A great example of a failure that I wasn't a part of, but certainly made an impression on me, in a facility that I worked in, was a wrong site surgery, and it related to a patient that had inflammatory bowel disease and multiple laparotomies and ostomies, and they ended up in the pre-op area, and the patient had incredible anxiety. The nurse was talking to him, said, what's the problem? I'm afraid that he's going to operate on the wrong ventral hernia. Oh, he's great. He's experienced. He's done all these other operations. It's going to be fine. Well, this continued on until they finally said, well, get anesthesia in here. This person's so anxious. You know, we need to take care of this. So they brought the CRNA or CRNA and MDA in, and, you know, same story again. So what was the solution? It was a simple solution, right? Sedate the patient. And what happened? They operated on the wrong ventral hernia. The simple solution was to just give them a black Sharpie and say, just tell me which one that we're going to operate on. You can't make a mistake. But again, the point in that being, keep it simple. Whatever we're doing, you know, if somebody gives me a mnemonic of four letters versus 12 letters, I'm always going to pick the four.
Jerry Caballero from Milwaukee. I run an acute care service, the busiest hospital in the state. We have a 24/7 model, 1 week at a time, and the following week doing clinic and then the rest of the time off with four surgeons rotating through. One of the main reasons that I instituted this, you know, almost 5 years ago was the problems with handoffs. I was concerned that if we had multiple shifts, that there would be multiple errors. So one is a question as to whether there's some data to support and validate this observation. I did use empirically most of the principles that you described today. So after 5 years, we have I can look back, and we have only had two near misses. So I'm, you know, very happy about that. Comments about who's on call. It took me a while to get the whole hospital to buy into having one pager for the service. So I had to re-educate all the different services, the nursing units, etc. But now we have one pager for the whole service, so that the call does not go to Dr. X, it goes to the service, and the new physician on call is carrying that pager. So that's made one improvement in the way the service and the communication is carried out. And the last comment is about patient expectations also. With this service, having various physicians changing every week, patients get a little confused, and expectations are, well, why isn't my doctor seeing me? So one other thing that I instituted on Sundays, because the service changes on Monday morning, on Sundays, whoever's making rounds on Sundays carries a card with the names of all the different surgeons that are on the service, and we put a check mark on the surgeon that is going to be on the service the following week, and we hand the card to the patient, say, well, I'm going off service in the morning. Dr. Smith is going to be taking care of you starting on Monday. And we leave that card with the patient or the family member. And that has also eased a lot of the miscommunication issues. So it was a question and some comments.
I'll make comment. Tying together that and a few of the others, I have sort of developed a checklist. I can't prove this, but when we look at these systems like you described, they need to be proactive. It's much better than reactive. Interactive or multidisciplinary. Precise. You have to have experts. Continuity, which you alluded to, the value of having a week so you don't have all this handoff. And scalable. If you have proactive, interactive, precise, expert, continuity, and scalable, you've got a pretty good system in healthcare.
Well, I have one final question for the panelists, and that is, getting back to the comment by the gentleman from Baltimore, is that we know that there's a wide variation in practice In the real world, there are lots of opportunities to improve communication in general and specifically during handoffs. A lot of the issue has to do with the fact that surgeons not always embrace structured communication. It does take time. There is a feeling that a lot of this is a waste of time because, you know, nothing ever bad happens to my patients. It's your patients that, you know, that end up having problems. How do we get across the idea that this is an important something to take seriously because patients do end up getting injured because of poor communication practices?
You touched on the Dunning-Kruger effect, the illusory superiority, and it's fascinating when this is studied in generic domains like grammar and humor and mathematics that people grossly overestimate their abilities. An example is 80% of United States citizens think they're above average drivers. Another example is they polled software engineers, company A and B, and said what percentage you were in the top 5% of software engineers, and I think it was 32% in software company A, and it was 42% in B. And I think, one, us knowing that, meaning that's a phenomenon, is important, but even sharing that with some of our deviants that think that they're truly superior has a way of changing the dynamic. And then I think, quite frankly, it's leadership skills to help people become better leaders, and then incumbent upon us that lead groups of people or lead teams to surface these sorts of things and go in the right direction. But it's a journey. It's a human phenomenon.
Yeah, I would add to the leadership, it also takes personal accountability and a willingness to partner. We can't do it alone. It has to be done in our role with our anesthesia counterparts and our nursing leadership from across the country.
But they seem to be much more interested in that this kind of multidisciplinary interaction and collaboration and structured communication than sometimes some of our surgeon colleagues are. And you, as a chair of surgery, you know, managing herding cats or herding saber-toothed tigers, how do you manage that so that we end up with a better, reliable, systematic approach to handoffs?
Well, we're fortunate. We have an administrative leadership team in our five-hospital system that realizes the importance of patient safety, so they're behind getting that done.
So organizational commitment and senior leadership commitment and setting a clear vision about expectations and behaviors and so on is important. And it's done easier in some organizations than others. So
Juan, to your point, you mentioned herding cats. We've often heard that and felt that. What I was told, it's like herding dolphins. They said they're a lot smarter and they're slipperier.
Okay, any other questions? Please.
Odysseus Argy from Massachusetts. I apologize for coming in late. Maybe this question has already been answered. But the connection between having a checklist and actually communicating information and processing the information that's communicated and making sure, you know, do we have the blood pressure? Yes, 60 over palp. Do we have the pulse? Yes, 142. And somehow, and just moving down the list and not realizing, wait a minute, that's abnormal. And this happened with a flight out of Washington, D.C. a number of years ago, 30 years ago, which crashed into the Potomac. And flight, you know, airlines have had checklists for years, and it works really, really well. Failure rates, you know, error rates in airlines are phenomenally small compared to error rates in medicine. We kill 400,000 patients in hospitals every year due to medical errors, but when we're supposed to be helping them. But the both pilots were from Florida. So it was snowing outside, and they said, flap de-icers off, yes, check. And the plane had ice all over the wings and crashed into the Potomac and killed lots of people. Is there a connection? How can we make the connection between communicating data and actually processing that data so everyone understands it and we work with real information that has value?
You point out something that's important and difficult, but I think that one of the guards is the way we always do it, the standard operating procedure. The other is having the team there and hearing these things, and you're hoping with a group of experts that somebody, you know, if there's a third party hears that, you know, the de-icer's not on, that they're going to say they need to be on. You know, I'll expand on that importance and give you a real-world example of that feedback. So I mentioned my life changing in a car accident. I was going from the Pacific Coast Highway to UCLA's emergency room in the back of a ambulance and freezing, and the EMS or paramedic called in and said that my blood pressure was 60 over palpation, exactly what you mentioned, and he said, and this is what he said it always is. And I remember thinking, I'm freezing, I'm in shock, 60 over palp is not normal for anybody. I had just told him, I don't know, it's usually 120 or 130 over 80 or something like that, and I had to say, no, that's not what, you know, my blood pressure is normally, to which the guy had this surprised look. I hope that the other person on the other end would have known that wasn't normal, but, you know, that was an example where I heard something and spoke up and said, no, this is not right.
You know, the other area where, as an organization across the country, we've struggled is related to the procedural timeout, where we've all got something written and the checklists are checked and the boxes are marked. But I think really what you're asking is, how do you create a culture in these checklists or handoffs that allows somebody to speak up when there's and so culture change is much more difficult than procedural change, but I think that they're true in both situations.
Any other questions? If not, then thank you all for coming.